I missed the last one, so I'm not really sure what we're doing. When you go up to your land,
I used to go up by myself. My son, when he gets back home, teacher in New Jersey. Over New York City, Oxford. Teacher for the charter school. He was a teacher for America.
Did he fall in love with pensions and retirement? Will come to order. I'm going to rearrange the schedule a little bit. Number one is going to be the review of the legislative audit report on pensions for volunteer firefighters. Ms. Voss, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Joe Voss, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. And I'm here to present just a quick summary of the report that we issued last January on volunteer firefighter pensions. As you already know, Minnesota has a pretty decentralized system when it comes to administering pensions for volunteer firefighters. And essentially, we looked at how well that system was working. The main message of our report is that we don't need to overhaul the entire system. However, we are concerned about the low rates of return that volunteer firefighter pension plans have earned over the last several years. And let me just explain now how we got to those conclusions. A decentralized system presents a certain amount of challenges. First of all, there's a lot of pension plans out there, and each plan is administered by a nonprofit corporation known as a Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association. And so we have 700 different associations, each one responsible for determining eligibility, setting benefit levels, and investing pension funds for their members. Pensions for volunteer firefighters are basically funded from three sources: investment income, state fire aid, and local government contributions, both mandatory and voluntary. 2004 was the data that was the most recent when we did our report, and in 2004, investment income made up the largest share of revenue. But this can and does vary from year to year. Depending on the stock market and the types of investments that relief associations have made. The relief associations closed out 2004 with about $357 million in assets. We looked at the pension benefits retired firefighters can receive, and we found that there's a lot of variation around the state. Most plans make one big lump sum payment to retirees based on their years of service. And most plans require that firefighters serve 20 years before retiring with full benefits. In 2004, median benefits for firefighters retiring after 20 years of service were $16,000. But depending on where the firefighter lived, they could have received as little as $500 or as much as $140,000. This is a big variation, but we don't think it's totally unreasonable. We found that relief associations that generally paid higher benefits also generally received more fire aid, and they responded to more fire calls in a given year. So they went out on more calls. They worked harder. We also looked at the overall health of the pension plans and found that most of them were in good shape. Basically, we looked at their funding ratios. In 2004, the median funding ratio was 106%. 65% of relief associations had ratios of 100% or more. 17% of funds had ratios of less than 90%. We also looked at the pension plan's administrative costs. As a whole, volunteer firefighter pension plans spent 0.42% of their total assets on administration in 2004. Now, this is quite a bit more than what the state's largest public employee pension plans pay. They typically pay around 0.07 or 0.08% of assets on administration. Yet again, we don't think that 0.42% is excessive. Over half of the volunteer relief association's administrative spending went to pay for actuarial or legal services or audit services. Most of the associations did not spend anything at all on salaries for their staff and or for their officers, and almost one-fifth reported no administrative costs at all. In our view, the high spending is largely a function of the relief associations not being able to take advantage of economies of scale. Now, up to this point, things have looked pretty good, and now is when we come to the point where we think there are some problems, and that's in the area of investments. We looked at the rates of return earned by the volunteer relief associations over an eight-year period. We found that relief associations earned, on average, an average annual rate of return of 4.8%. This ranged anywhere from a negative 2.7% up to a high of 13.7%. Now, we do think the 4.8 is low compared with what other plans earned during the same time period, and also compared with what the relief associations could have earned. For example, during the same time period, the State Board of Investments Basic Fund earned 8%. SBI's income share account, which volunteer relief associations can invest in if they want to, that fund earned 7.7%. We also compared the rate of return earned by the relief associations with a hypothetical composite, and we refer to it on the slide as the benchmark composite. And we developed this composite based on the actual percentages of assets that relief associations allocated to stocks and to bonds and to cash equivalents over the eight-year period. And then we said, well, what if you invested these same amounts in some common stock indices and some common bond indices and 6-month CDs, what would you have ended up with? Well, if relief associations would have invested in this way, instead of choosing the stocks and the bonds and the CDs that they did choose, they would have earned an average annual rate of return of 6.3% instead of the 4.8. Now, the bright note on this slide, if you can call it bright, is that most of the relief associations did beat the Consumer Price Index. And that's a goal that some of the relief associations actually have when they make their investments. They just want to do better than the CPI. But 7% of the associations, which comes to about 47 plans, didn't even beat the CPI. And in fact, 8 plans had negative rates of return over the entire 8-year period, which means that they actually lost instead of gained money. Now, relief associations, by law, can invest through SBI if they want to. They can invest through the Supplemental Investment Fund, which gives them access to 6 different accounts, including the income share account that I showed on the previous slide. Well, we did a survey of all relief associations, and we asked them about their investment practices and why they did what they did. And when we asked about SBI, they told us that they weren't even familiar with SBI. 41% of the Relief Association said that they weren't familiar with SBI. In total, less than a third of the Relief Associations use SBI to invest their funds. In 2004, it was less than a third. I think it's right up to slightly more than a third at the latest count. But not many people use them. In addition to being unfamiliar with SBI, many associations told us that they didn't use SBI or only invested a small portion of their funds with the investment board because they thought they could do better than SBI. They were sure they could beat them. Well, in reality, only 28 of the 700 and some volunteer funds actually earned the same rate of return or did better than SBI over that over the 8 years. So it's not likely that a volunteer relief association is going to do better than the State Board of Investment. In fact, we estimated that if relief associations had invested all of their, or almost all of their pension funds in SBI's income share account over the last 8 years, they would have earned an additional $56 million in investment income. And this is money that they could have used to increase benefits if they wanted to, or to decrease the amount of local contributions that some local jurisdictions are required to make. Now, we also looked at a small sample of relief associations' investment policies. And we think that policies are important because they help ensure public accountability. We looked at 60 policies. Only 12 of those policies, or 20%, actually described a strategy for investing funds and then had some measurable goals for their investments. Only 13 policies, 22%, required some periodic review of the investment policy from time to time, just to simply see how well it was working. Okay, so where does this leave us? Well, in our report, we discussed various options that the legislature could consider to improve pension administration. Overall, we decided against recommending any large, drastic, major changes in how pensions are administered. However, we did make a recommendation regarding investments, and we recommended that the legislature require all voluntary fire relief associations to invest their pension funds through SBI. We think that this will likely result in higher investment income, lower investment costs, somewhat less paperwork, and it would also reduce the need to have local relief associations get some training in how to make wise investments and how to set up an investment strategy. Under this recommendation, relief associations would still be responsible for determining eligibility, setting benefit levels, and paying benefits. And they would still have to decide how to invest their funds within the options available to them through the Supplemental Investment Fund. So they could still be able to design a investment portfolio to reflect their own local needs. Now, we recognize there's not a great deal of support for this recommendation. When we did our surveys of relief associations and local government officials, we asked them about a variety of options. And 5% or less of relief associations and local governments thought that this was a good idea. So we also said, okay, if the legislature decides that they don't want to do this, what should happen? Well, we think then that SBI will need to step up this outreach program. And in our report, we mention a few ways that they could do this, just to increase awareness and familiarity with SBI. Then we also made another recommendation, and that would be that the legislature should require relief associations to develop an annual investment report card that would compare its investment performance with the association's own goals as set forth in their investment policy, as well as with some benchmarks that are set by the State Auditor's Office. And in this respect, we think SBI's income share account should certainly be a benchmark. Relief associations should distribute this report card to their members. We think in this way it might foster more change from the bottom up in a relief in an association as opposed to fostering change from the top down. We also recommend that the legislature require relief associations to develop investment policies that incorporate best practices. Again, we think this is a good idea for public accountability purposes. And that is our report in a nutshell. We have a complete listing of all of our recommendations on page 59 in our report. So if you have any questions, I will be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Voss. I have a couple.
Okay.
Before you issued the report, did you seek counsel from the State Investment Board?
We did talk
about your recommendations.
Representative Murphy, we talked with people from the Investment Board. We did not specifically tell them before we issued the report that we were going to be issuing this recommendation, although I guess we did send them a draft and they commented on it and everything, and I don't believe, if I can recall, that they were opposed to taking on all of the relief associations.
And Ms. Voss, on this report card, would the Legislative Auditors Commission draw up the report card, or who would draw up the report card?
We didn't, Representative Murphy, Commission members, we didn't specify who should do it, but it would probably, I would think it would be logical to have the State Auditor's Office and perhaps their working group, the Fire Relief, Voluntary Relief Association working group, work to develop the report card. The State Auditor's annual reports that they release every year does contain a number of benchmarks, and we would just like to see that information go to individual members of the relief association.
And then my final question is, when you were talking about the administrative costs were high, but they were reasonable, was there any correlation between the administrative costs and the annual rates of return? The groups that had good annual rates of return, were they across the board on the costs for administrating it, or were they not?
Representative Murphy, I can't recall. I can get back to you
on
that.
Okay. I just kind of wondered. And then also the groups that didn't have any administrative costs, what were their returns like?
Oh, I'll get back to you on that.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, thank you, Ms. Voss. I'd be interested to hear a little bit more. Frankly, it surprised me that in light of the fact that you mentioned that only 28 of the relief associations would have incurred more positive returns, you commented that they were not, as a rule, supportive of the recommendation to utilize the SBI. And I'm finding kind of a disconnect there, because it seems that the facts would speak rather loudly here. So perhaps you could further offer some further comment on that.
Ms. Voss.
Representative Murphy, Senator Lynch. I guess I would agree with you that it does seem strange that when you can actually earn higher rates of return using the state board, why you don't do it. Now, we did talk with people who called me and did surveys and everything, and they liked, some of the relief associations like to invest locally, use their local banks, buy CDs from them, use the local stockbroker. Others, I think, I did hear from some people who were afraid that they would not be able to get their money when they wanted it. Thought back at many of them, some of them referred back to the days when the state had pension problems or deficits, and they stopped making contributions to the state employee pension plans, and they were just concerned that at some point the state might decide that this money was theirs. That was a small share of them, along with just the desire to invest locally. And then there's the thought that they could do better. So it's a combination of factors.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don't we already have in statute that they have to do an investment plan and set performance goals? What more do you want them to do, or are they just not following statute?
Ms. Voss.
Representative Murphy, Representative Thiessen. We thought the investment policies were lacking. A lot of them didn't have... they didn't set forth a strategy. They had a document, but it wasn't necessarily... Some of them just said, we will invest in our local banks, and that was all they said. Other ones would lay out, you know, we think we need 20% in mutual in bonds, 60% in stock, and we need a cash reserve of 20%. And this is what we expect in our expect our mutual funds to get a rate of return of at least 3%. And that's what we wanted to see in more of the plans than they actually have.
Representative Thiessen.
And so I guess my question is, do we need to change the statute to make that more clear, or is our statute sufficient and we just need better enforcement of that? And I guess the other question is, is there anything in statute, I mean, do these boards have the expertise to do that, or is there something in statute that prevents them from obtaining that kind of advice that they would need to set those kind of investment policies?
Ms. Voss.
Representative Murphy, Representative Thiessen. The statutes do require a lot of the relief association people are not professionals, they're not investment people. But they are required by law to get the necessary training in order to make prudent investments. And so it is one of their responsibilities to to set forth a strategy. And they, right now they make it, they utilize other people in towns to help set forth a strategy. We want to see something on paper with goals so that you can actually hold yourself accountable and to review and a policy to actually review the investment policy periodically.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Voss. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to comment or rebut or... Please.
Do I just sit here or...
Nope, you go down here and you tell us who you are.
My name is Colleen Hartman-Ballum.
Pardon me?
My name is Colleen Hartman-Ballum. I work for a firm called Harman and Hartman Financial Group, and I have been working with relief associations for 11 years at least in various incarnations of my previous firms, which was originally starting with Piper Jaffray, which was acquired last year. I also own a company called Minnesota Firefighter Pension Consultants. It's not profitable yet. My husband would argue it's my volunteer hobby, but it is my attempt at trying to bring some of the private sector standards as it relates to bylaws or plan documents that we would use in a corporate environment for a dentist office or a manufacturing firm to the volunteer fire service. And so basically it's model bylaws where you check off the options, and then the model bylaws, all of the options have been reviewed by a law firm because I am not an attorney. And it works, provides pension forms and all of the things that a relief association should run to help them run the nonprofit aspects of the relief association. Because in Minnesota state law, relief associations are nonprofit corporations under 317A, but also to attempt to comply with the volunteer firefighter statutes under 424A. I have several things about the study, and I'm going to have to wear both sides of my hats. That's why I want to be very clear on who I'm representing, because I'm kind of representing both organizations. I do not want to represent any particular fire relief association. That's not my intent. I do a lot of training statewide for the various fire service organizations, and I think I have a pretty good broad brush of relief associations. And also, to be fully disclose, I live in St. Paul, so we don't have a volunteer fire service in my community. Okay. First of all, regarding state statutes, and I'm sure Larry Martin or someone here can clarify this, my understanding is if you have less than $1 million, unless you have a certain percentage, and actually if I look at my book here, Statute 356A.06 requires relief associations with under $1 million to have used the limited list of authorized investments, which basically include CDs, savings accounts, government obligations, which are very much what I would consider fixed income investments. The Office of the Legislative Auditor Study used the balanced option in the State Board of Investments, which is a 60-40 blend. And so if you're from the investment community, it's kind of like comparing apples to bananas. When you typically compare investment returns, you compare like asset classes. So that's the first comment I want to make. Relief associations that have less than $1 million can use the state board and can use an investment advisor, but the reality is I think the average pension is under $300,000 in the state. And in some of these communities, they're very small, so they don't necessarily have an investment provider in their local community. But they do have a bank, and I think, like Joe said, they oftentimes support the bank because, and I'm not saying this is the best investment returns, but statutorily it's very easy to, because that's the restrictions that they're under. But also, the nonprofit aspect of the Relief Association has them do a lot of community events, and they rely on their community to support them. Like last night, I was at Ham Lake Fire, and they had a bunch of candy canes because they take the fire trucks around, and they have Santa on the fire trucks and all sorts of things as part of their community aspect and the local control aspect of relief associations. So a couple things in defense or just a different way of looking at the OLA study is that I don't think it really compared apples to apples from an investment perspective. If the state wants to require every relief association to be a 60-40, then put that in statute. It would be a lot easier for the investment professionals just to have them invested that way. However, I will tell you that when the market declined, I had relief associations that had pension obligations, and if the right firefighters retired, meaning those with a lot of years of experience, they probably would have lost 60% of their pension portfolio just because those firefighters, relative to the size of the pension, had accrued years of service, and had they elected to retire, they would have taken those assets with them. Because the way pensions work is the participant or the member gets to decide when they're going to retire, not the plan itself, assuming they meet the eligibility requirements for retirement, which is over age 50 and having the vested portion of the benefit. Regarding the State Board of Investments, when I teach across the state and relief association trustees talk about how they have an investment advisor they haven't seen in year after year, you know, I typically recommend they should invest with the state board, because the fact of the matter is they're paying a lot more for a private sector financial professional than the state board for the same amount of service. In the OLA study itself, it talked about how the State Board of Investments, although it's a very inexpensive investment option, and I would tell you that it is a very inexpensive investment option, it does not have the ability to provide investment advice. So in the private sector, you cannot provide investment advice unless you have a contractual relationship with the client. The State Board of Investments, if they can't provide investment advice, I'm fearful that if it's mandated, I don't know where the trustees are going to get the expertise. My experience with firefighters is they're great community people. They're not stupid, because when all of you are in your own community and your house goes on fire, which is your biggest asset, who do you call? The firefighters? I mean, they're smart enough to be able to put out a house fire to protect your largest asset, but they can't run their own pension fund. So the state board has always been an option. I've competed against it for years. In some cases, it's the best option, and I would not discredit it, but I think we need to realize what services the state board can provide a decentralized fire service system if the objective is to remain local, have local control remain. As far as the report card, I also agree that, you know, the State Auditor's Office for years has been tracking investment performance. I would argue that comparing their comparison also to a balanced fund is assuming that everyone has to invest as a balanced fund, which is a 60 equity, 40% fixed income. But I think an annual report card, these are nonprofit corporations, and they have members as shareholders. So every year, they should have an annual meeting where they elect the officers to the board. It seems to me that the annual meeting is really where they ratify and understand their investment return. The reality is for the relief associations that are not getting their investment performance provided to them on a quarterly basis from their investment advisor, which is the service I provide to my relief association clients, they have to wait 13 months or so to get the report from the State Auditor's Office. So when you're looking for investment returns, my question is, who are you asking to do this? You know, it is provided by the State Auditor's Office, albeit 13 months behind. If they're not working with a professional, the State Board of Investments will typically provide it after their year end. But the State Board of Investments is not set up on a calendar year. Their fiscal year is a June 30th. Their performance reporting, you can't go online like Vanguard and see how the performance is doing. So I think you need to understand the differences between the State Board. It's a very low-cost investment option. It's easy, but it's low-cost, but obviously it hasn't provided a lot of service, or more relief associations, I think, would have moved that direction.
Any questions? Thank you. Are you on the working group, or do you attend the working group?
I am an interested member of the public, but not allowed to speak unless called on.
And are you called on?
Last week I was the investment professionals in the room were called on to comment on a possible statute change about using broker-dealers with SPIC insurance, SIPC insurance.
And do the individual fire departments contract with you? Is that?
Yes. For my bylaw company, they have a one-time kind of setup fee and then an annual maintenance fee, on average about $350 a year. To help keep them compliant as state statutes change. It's very similar to a private sector model. And then on my investment clients, it's a fee-based. In most cases, a discretionary. And I provide quarterly performance reports, education through the fire schools, and assorted municipal negotiations, you name it, I've done it. So.
Could you share one of those reports with us? At some future time?
A performance report?
Yeah.
I can ask. Obviously, there's a kind of a client. I may be able to get one of my clients to come and share their performance report. I need to be respectful.
Thank you.
They own the data.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative? No. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Did anyone else have a response? Mr. Zickman?
Madam Chair, members, Niall Zickman representing the Coalition of the Volunteer Fire Service Groups, the Fire Chiefs, the Fire Department Association, the Relief Association Group, and then we also have the Fire Marshals and Fire Investigators who are particularly driven in the study, but many of them are members of the Volunteer Fire Department. If the chair is willing, I was going to kind of just comment on the whole study and the purpose and what we hope to do with it versus responding to the study.
Fine. In 5 minutes?
Madam Chair, I will do it in 5 minutes or less. The study was, in some part, originated by the MNFAC group, which had been searching for a study to the whole volunteer pension problem for, dating back to 7 years when Senator Johnson was the chair of this committee. And so, in a sense, we drove the study. The purpose of the study was to actually determine if there was an interest statewide in an alternative to the current system, decentralized system. And that was primarily driven by the fact that the workforce issues are starting to come into play in the volunteer fire service. In the last 10 years, we've not seen an increase in the number of volunteer firefighters despite an increase in the population. We just barely maintain a status quo. So it was kind of a a recruitment or retention workforce issue, and the problem is the volunteer firefighter doesn't even have enough time to do the firefighter training, attend to the other duties, cleaning the trucks, maintaining the equipment, and in their spare time they're supposed to be volunteer relief trustees, and they're simply overwhelmed, primarily in the smaller departments, but that describes 500 of the 700 departments. And so there was a survey as part of the OALA study that did come back and suggested there was fully about half of the plans that said, show us an alternative, let us take a look at it, because we might be interested. There was close, if you extrapolate the numbers, there's 100 plans that said, you know what, why don't you just have the state take this over because it's just too much for us. You know, that suggests, you know, that there was a need, you know, to look for an alternative. So a working group was formed by those professional associations. We've been working with commission staff. We have a draft of a bill. We've made some revisions to that. We hope to have that draft back in the next couple of weeks. Mr. Martin is working on that. We intend to publish that on our web pages, take comments from our members through till session starts, and come back before you with a bill that will create a statewide plan that you can join on a voluntary basis. It would be managed by MSRS. It would be the administrative portion would be managed by MSRS. The investments would be managed by the SBI. It would have a board of directors, gubernatorial appointed. It would include a minimum benefit level of $20,000, which would provide, that's a 20-year pension. It would provide $1,000 a year to that volunteer firefighter. There's minimum benefit levels out there of $8,000 right now. They serve 20 years, their community, and they get $8,000. So we wanted to put that in there to get a minimum floor. There's some other provisions. We can go into detail more when the bill comes before you. There is some opposition to the bill. It's primarily coming from the large plans that are maybe not fully apprised of all the details yet. The maximum benefit is $80,000, so this isn't a target for the large plans. That's not who needs the help. But some of them might be threatened because they think this could roll over to a mandatory plan at some date. That could only occur by your doing. So I guess with that, Madam Chair, I would just share with you that we used the study to determine if there was interest. It appears there is strong interest. We've got a draft we're going to put out there, get some more feedback, some more interest, bring that back. The goal would be to pass the bill if there's still interest. That would create the board, and it'd still take a year to get the board up and running. So we'd be back in the 09 session, and I would close with the fact that the governor has been briefed on this and face-to-face, and there's been a follow-up with the Commissioner of Public Safety because we indicated to him there would be additional monies to help jumpstart the plan. And I guess I would be accurate in stating that he was interested in this concept, very interested in working on workforce issues with the volunteer fire reliefs. And I quoted him a number of $15 million to get the plan jump-started, and I said I could be off by half, and I didn't mean $7 million. So... I think my 5 minutes are up, Madam Chair. Okay.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Voss. We appreciate the work. And we will wait in anticipation for the bill. Members, in your packet is the... May 8th and August 20th meeting minutes of the commission.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Senator Larson moves the passage of or the approval of the minutes for the 4th and 5th meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are approved as written. The report by the number 5, report by the Teachers Retirement Association on the transition from Minneapolis to TRA. Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Laurie Hacking, TRA Executive Director. I'll be very brief, maybe even a minute instead of 5 minutes. just a quick report, or hopefully final report, on how consolidation has gone with Minneapolis teachers, the former Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund Association. As you know, law was passed and effective July 1 of 2006 to merge Minneapolis teachers into the large statewide TRA fund. That merger, I'm here to report to you, has gone very well and is largely done. On an operational administrative perspective, monthly payments have been going out every month to Minneapolis teachers on time with no interruption in payments. We have absorbed the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund Association employees into our staff. Several of them have filled vacated positions in our staff and SBI staff. The office, all the members are now being served through the TRA office, and the MTRFA offices have been closed. Most importantly, all the data records from Minneapolis teachers have been integrated into our TRA systems. That was a very major undertaking, requiring a lot of programming work, et cetera, but that has been done, and they are now part of our automated systems. The Minneapolis School District has experienced some problems with their new payroll system, and that has had spillover effects on TRA. But we are working through those problems, and most of those problems have been resolved. There are still a few issues that are going to require some manual intervention, but I'd say for the most part we are on a positive track there. Financially, the assets were transferred in mid-June, with the exception of a liquidating trust of about $1.5 million that was set aside by the former board and director to cover certain costs. That liquidating trust was the subject of a lawsuit, and long story short, that lawsuit was settled in December, and the liquidating trust was dissolved, and those assets were transferred over to TRA. So that is done. So in conclusion, really, the consolidation has been successfully completed. In terms of the financial impact on our systems, the law has set up additional contributions that are coming to TRA, as well as redirecting some local and state aid to TRA to help us fund the liabilities that we have assumed. So that is on track. We are receiving that aid. We are receiving those additional contributions. And financially, the impact should be neutral on our active fund. And the same with respect to the post fund. The Minneapolis teachers retirees were transferred into the post fund at the same funding ratio as all the three systems participating in the post fund. So the post fund, there was a neutral impact by that consolidation. So in summary, that completes my report. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Hacking, would you speak more, a little more on the consolidation lessons learned?
Oh, sure.
Please.
Just those are two little points to make. That financially, I think one lesson learned is that it is best to deal with any emerging financial problems sooner rather than later, because they just simply become more expensive financially if you let a system like Minneapolis, which had a deteriorating financial situation, that was pretty clear, and I think it would have been best, look in hindsight, to have tried to achieve consolidation sooner rather than later. And administratively, really, I think the same thing we've learned. Originally, the legislation contemplated a one-year transition period, but we found in retrospect that the pace is better, faster, and better for the members if we try to achieve that consolidation on a date certain, bring the staff in, and things will move a lot more quickly and in a positive direction for the members if we do that, rather than having a lengthy kind of transition period that I think would present some administrative challenges.
Okay. And Ms. Hacking, has your board heard from members that are already retired about that they're not getting as good of results as they did prior to the merger, to the transition, and so that's all the result of the Minneapolis teachers coming into TRA?
Madam Chair and members, no, not really. I mean, we receive your normal types of complaints that we get from all of our members who maybe there might be some hitch in the processing, but no, nothing that's unusual coming from Minneapolis. In fact, to the contrary, we've heard a lot of positive comments that they are relieved that they're in a secure, relatively secure pension system now, and that was in some doubt before. So I think in general it's been more of a positive reaction, and there have been very few negative problems.
I just from comments that people have told me, I think there's still a need for outreach to people to say how well it's working. And I don't know how that could be done or anything else, but I just say, that's not true. And so I tried to clarify, but it's still being talked about, but not by active people.
Okay. Madam Chair, that's a good suggestion. We did a lot of outreach initially to explain how the merger was going to work and how people were going to be impacted, but perhaps there's some need for follow-up mm-hmm. on that. We did it over a year ago, and probably it's time maybe to do that more consistently. So that's a good suggestion. Thank you.
Because I think your report is very right on and very good. And Representative Thiessen, you were the author, and so what do you think?
Well, there were other authors that were actually ahead of me, including Representative Smith, but I'm glad that it's all worked out. So I don't have any other comments.
Okay. Representative Smith.
I concur.
Well, I'm glad. I'm sure glad it was done, and I tend to agree with it's best to deal as soon as possible with problem, financial problem, and get it out of the way so you can go on fixing. Right. Any other comments or questions? Anyone? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Then, Ms. Vanek, a report by the statewide retirement plans on post-retirement investment meetings that you've been having around. I went to one.
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I'm Mary Vanek, Director of PERA. Actually, the three funds have put together a presentation on the post-fund proposal. I will comment quickly, though, that the PERA Board of Trustees did hold three town meetings, one in Duluth, one in Austin, and one in Wilmer, and the discussion was quite lively in Duluth at the one that you attended, and we walked out of that meeting unsure whether we had any real support for the proposal. I can report that in Austin and Wilmer, however, the consensus by applause from the group was that they felt that the board was acting in their best interest and wanted us to do what was ever prudent in working with the legislature and ensuring the integrity of their funds. So there was no vote up or down on the proposal, but just seemed to be confidence that we were at least taking the time to look at it and come up with recommendations on how to address the future. So that's what we've experienced through our town meetings.
Okay.
But we're going to share briefly with you a presentation today, and we'll go through it as quickly as we can. I understand in August when I was unable to attend that there was a report on the post fund, but we thought it would be helpful to go over the highlights of the structure again. The post-retirement fund is a unique structure in Minnesota. We have our three active funds. The state employees have their own pool, and these are only representative of the general employee plans. We all each, or MSRS and PARA also administer some smaller plans. We did not include this in the information that's being presented to you. However, in the post-retirement fund, anybody who has retired from any of the funds that we administer, defined benefit plans, are participants in that fund, and the benefits are paid out of that fund, and earnings on that fund are have driven the past investment increases that have been paid. The key point we want to make about the current structure is that the only source of income for the post-retirement fund, once participants are in there, is investment performance. Investment returns are what provide the income for the post-retirement fund once an individual has transferred. And what we do is when somebody retires, we calculate the value of their lifetime pension. We discount that by a certain percentage. In state law, it's 6%. We transfer that money into the post fund, and then the investments earned on the post-retirement fund are intended to make sure that 100% of the benefit will be covered for life, plus make more, which will cover the cost of living adjustment and any additional increases that are allowed by law. So now that through market performance, the post fund has less assets than the long-term obligations of the fund, the only source of income to recover our investment earnings. And that's why we're talking about this issue. Changes made over time. This structure was created in 1969. This is not unique. This is not new, but it is unique. In 1969, none of the major plans were very well funded. The legislature decided to set aside a separate pool of assets for the retirees so that they could feel sure that the money was there to pay their benefits. It's gone through a couple of transformations in how it was to be invested and what would generate the increases. 69 to 80, they paid hardly anything in increases out of that fund because of the investments not earned. From 80 to 93, it was a realized income-driven performance to pay increases. Interest rates were high. The bond portfolio provided some good returns. There were outstanding gains in the market, so the realized capital gains from the stock portfolio also fueled increases. In 8 out of 13 years, the post-retirement fund paid increases that exceeded the CPI. By 1992, 80% of the portfolio was in bonds. No longer were interest rates high. No longer were the dividend returns going to even match what we needed to make to keep the benefits 100% funded. And so a new design was created and drove more of the asset allocation into stocks. And as a result of that, the post-retirement fund had outstanding earnings throughout the 90s. And the formula was driven or was set up so that those excess investment returns averaged over 5 years would pay additional increases. So when we earned 19% in 97 and 20% in 98, all of that extra money fueled the increases that we paid that on average during that period of time came to be 9.7% a year. But then if we go back again to the earlier page, which I'm not going to be able to do now, you see when the markets dropped in 01 through 03, now we lost return, and the result was that the increases dropped down to what the formula provides of inflation up to 2.5%. And there were no more excess investment earnings to share because any additional investments earned after that period had to stay in the fund to help get the fund assets back to 100%. This is a different picture of that same performance. Throughout the 90s, the assets of the fund continued to accrue. To one point in 1998, we had 134% of what we needed to pay long-term obligations in the fund. By 2001, we had dropped below 100% funding. By 2003, we were down to 76% funded in the post-retirement fund. That's when we started advocating at least let's cap future increases and hope that the fund will recover. So we started advocating in 2004 to put a 5% cap on future increases. We had already recovered $1 billion through the State Board's excellent investment return from 2003 to 2004, a 16% return moved us from 76 to 82% funded in 1 year. So we were hopeful that the way the post fund is structured was going to get us there. But then the next 2 years, we got up to 84%, 84% again. And now again, in this last year, the SBI returned over 18%, which moved us up to over 91% funded for the most recent fiscal year ending June 30th. So that's all good news, but we all know what the markets do and what the markets have been doing. So the proposal that is going to be presented to you tries to cover both sides, the good news going forward and the potential for the bad news that could occur.
My name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. And as Mary mentioned, the structure of the post fund has changed several times over the years, and more recently we wanted to make some other changes. In 1999 and 2000, we did propose a legislation that would have smoothed the gains and losses in the post fund from 5 years to 10 years. That never gained much momentum and support and did not get enacted. In 2005, we did propose capping cost of living increases at 5%. That was passed by the legislature in 2006. And then in late 2006, we formed a post-fund committee comprised of the three board members of the three statewide retirement systems. That committee met 7 times over the last year. I will talk a little bit about the guiding principles they have established. They did inform and involve members through various groups, through letters, through emails, and heard testimony at many different meetings. We did look at over 10 different proposals, ranging from do nothing to an immediate merger of the post fund, plus other modifications of that. At this point, we would like to present our draft proposal, which does incorporate some of the feedback that we did receive from our membership. So moving on to the proposal, and what the committee did first is they started with principles. The first principle they adopted was that the mechanism we use for cost of living adjustments should be more inflation sensitive, provide some greater inflation protection. Those increases should be more consistent and less volatile. The increase mechanism would be affordable and sustainable over time. The key of this committee is wanting pension plans that are financially secure, and that has been their overriding concern, is to make sure that the three statewide plans sustain strong financial positions. And we want to minimize the cost to employees and employers in this whole process. So those were kind of the guiding principles that the committee established earlier. The committee did undergo a lot of communication efforts, as indicated on the next page. We had stakeholder groups and members at all of our committees. They were all at each of the hearings. They were given opportunity to speak. We dedicated the August meeting to getting feedback. That's all we did at that meeting, is explain the proposal and get feedback from the unions and stakeholders and retiree groups, as well as the members. We got input from the other retirement funds and the legislative auditor. On an ongoing basis, we continue to make presentation to retiree groups, to our active members. We have met with the boards or the groups of decision makers of the various stakeholders. We sent out a special newsletter in April of 2007. We continue in each newsletter to inform our members as well. And in our seminars and presentations, we are incorporating a discussion about the proposals that we have had. In addition to that, Mary mentioned the town meetings that PERA conducted in Duluth, Austin, and Wilmer. So what the committee did is met 7 times. They took input from members and have come up with the following proposal. The first page explains the proposal in a broad sense, and then we'll get into more detail as we move forward. And we really have come up with 2 proposals, and the reason for that is we do not know which way the stock market is going to go. So on the left-hand side, we have the bull market, the optimism, we're going to have strong investment returns, and that the post-fund deficit would be eliminated. On the right-hand side will be the bear market, and that would be if the markets turn downward and our post-fund deficit increases. So our hope is and would be good for all of us is if the post-fund continues. If the post-fund continues, that means we've had strong investment returns. Our active funds would be in good shape. Our post-fund would be in good shape. What the committee decided, and I will explain this in more detail in a minute, is that if the post fund continues, we would like to make it more investment oriented or inflation oriented rather than just pure investment based. We have come up with an 8 inflation equalizer for more recent retirees. We would continue to have the 5% cap, total cap on increases, and also that if that post fund ever recovers to a level of 115% or higher, future boards would then determine proposal and come to the legislature with a proposal on if that should be used to increases to retirees. The theory here is we don't know what's going to happen between now and the point where we're going to reach 115% funded, if in fact that ever happens. It's not likely to happen in my career here, but we're going to leave that decision to other folks. So on the positive side, that's what we are looking at, having the post fund continue. If we reach a certain funding level in that post fund, we're going to abolish, or we're proposing to abolish, the post fund. And at that point, the active fund from each of our plans would absorb back their share of the post fund. So MSRS would take back into their fund their share of the post fund. PERA would take back theirs, and the teachers' retirement would take back theirs. So we're not talking about, when we're talking about post fund merger, we're not talking about a merger of the 3 systems. And I emphasize that because we get that a lot. So MSRS would still be an entity, teachers' retirement would still be an entity in PERA. It's just we would take our active portions and retired portions and put them together. At that point, we would pay a flat 2.5% cost of living adjustment every year rather than inflation up to 2.5%. And each board then would meet, look at their benefit structure, and decide if other changes would be made. So if you turn to the next page to get into more detail, and I am going to focus on what happens in a positive market scenario. Again, we have the cute little bull on the top of the page to emphasize that. And we are proposing some structural changes to the post fund. So on the left-hand side, we see what happens under current law. And on the right-hand, what the committee is proposing to introduce this coming legislative session. Current law provides inflation protection of up to 2.5%. If the post fund continues, we would not change that. We would continue to provide inflation protection up to 2.5%. What would change, however, is our investment component. Under current law, once we get over 100% funded, we share investment gains above that, whether or not there is inflation. We share those gains because we have those excess dollars. Okay, so it's not tied to inflation. It's if we have it, we pay it out. However, we only can have a total increase of up to 5%. So we have the 2.5% base. In no means could the increase ever go above 5. So under the current mechanism, we're paying investment returns just because we have the money. If the post fund continues, we are proposing that be changed to more inflation-oriented. So we would still need to be over 100% funded. We would still need to have excess assets. But rather than paying it out because we have it, we would pay it out to make up for higher inflation during those periods. We would continue to have the 5% cap, and then we would also look at having an equalizer during periods of low inflation and high returns, and I'll go into more details about that. So the biggest structural change we plan on is in that investment component, where we're trying to tie it more to inflation, which is consistent with the principles, your current principles of the Pension Commission, and also the recommendation in the auditor report, is to make it more inflation-oriented. So if you turn to the next page, getting into a little more detail, again, under the post-fund continuing, so this is the positive stock market or market return, we would continue to have the inflation adjustment up to 2.5%. I talked about replacing the investment portion with more inflation, and you can see the example down below. So let's say inflation was 3.75. The initial inflation would be 2.5%. That would be the inflation up to 2.5%. Plus, we'd provide an additional 1.25%, bringing the total up to 3.75. Now, at this point, we could have had enough assets to pay 5%, but under our proposal, we wouldn't. Those assets would stay in the post fund and would provide future higher inflation protection as well. So, again, rather than paying it because it's there, it would be tied to inflation. On the next page, we describe a new feature that we are proposing, and this was to meet the needs of people who have retired more recently and have lost purchasing power. With the inflation equalizer, what we would do is in periods where inflation was under 2.5% and investments exceed 8.5%, and the post fund has to be over 90% funded. So if we have a solid, or if we're in a solid financial position and we have high returns for that year and low inflation, we would propose an inflation equalizer. In the example that we show here in the blue, it has, let's say, inflation of 2%. All retirees would get the 2% increase because that's the cost of living adjustment up to 2.5. That would pay everybody the 2%. The people who have lost purchasing power would get an additional 0.5% increase. So that would provide some level of relief, albeit relatively small over time, but hopefully over time we can get them back. If you look on the next page, you can get a better sense of who would be affected by the equalizer. If you look, for example, to the yellow box starting in 2002, you can see that more recent retirees, which would be after the stock market fell, have lost some portion of inflation depending on when they were first eligible for increases. For example, in 2008, we're going to pay our retirees a 2.5% increase. Inflation for the period that we used, June 30th to June 30th, was 2.67. So that group of retirees would have fallen behind inflation by 0.17%. Somebody who was first eligible for an increase in 2003 and 4 and 5 are about 3% behind what inflation was. And you can see back in the chart in 1994, that group of retirees greatly exceeds what they had gotten inflationary-wise. So the inflation equalizer is designed to take, you know, to try to make a modest step to bring the purchasing power back for the more recent retirees who have lost some ground. So that is the half-full scenario. The glass is half-full. The stock market rebounding, and Lori will explain the half-empty scenario.
Yeah, I'll be the bear.
You'll be the bear. Yes.
Lori Hacking with TRA. Dave has covered this pretty thoroughly, but I'll just mention some important points here. If the markets are sluggish or turn negative, then we are contemplating a merger of the post and active funds under our proposal. They start with that yellow box, which explains what would trigger a merger. The committee and the board spent a lot of time talking about these triggers, and actually we are still refining them. There's still some differences of opinion, but what we're generally looking at is that if the post fund dipped below 85% funded it for two consecutive years or below 80% in 1 year, then merger would be triggered. And recall, we're standing at about 91.5% funded currently. We selected these trigger levels with the idea that we don't want the post fund deficit to become so large that it becomes unmanageable. And we also want to be able to tell our retirees and active members that we have a plan in the event the deficit does get large, that we're not going to let things deteriorate to such a level. So if those triggers were breached, or those levels were breached, we would then dissolve the post fund, and each of our three systems has a share of the post fund. Even though we're all together in this fund, we nevertheless account for what is TRA's share, PARA's share, MSRS's share of both the assets and liabilities of the post fund. Roughly speaking, TRA owns about half of the post fund, MSRS about 18%, and PARA about 35%. So if merger is triggered, what happens is we carve up the post fund, and those portions will be merged with each of our active funds, and then we will have a combined fund for each of the three systems. And again, this will happen for the smaller funds like PARA, Police and Fire, MSRS, State Patrol. Those will all go through the same merger process. Next page. We requested our actuaries to do some analysis of regarding what is the probability that the post fund will actually reach full funding again. And what they came back with, their analysis showed that in any given year, we have only a 20 to 25% chance that the post fund will reach 100% funded again. So that really told us and told the committee that we need to plan for this high probability event that the post fund will not reach full funding. And that this analysis was kind of important in selecting the triggers and our decision that we really can't sit by and do nothing. We really do have to have a proposal. We also asked our actuary to look at a scenario that is not a whole lot different from what we're actually experiencing, and that scenario is, let's assume we have zero earnings this year. And you all know the markets have been extremely volatile in the last few months. I think we are above zero, but we are still in the low single digits, which would be very harmful for the post fund if that continues. We have until June 30th, so we really measure what our investment return is, but we don't know what's going to happen. But let's assume there was a 0% return. Our 91% funding ratio in 1 year would drop significantly to 83%. So that's how big of an impact investment returns has on the post fund, and it shows you that it is very vulnerable. The post fund is very vulnerable to market downturns and negative returns. So that's why we feel very strongly that we need to take action to have a plan in the event that happens. Dave explained to you that if merger does happen, we would move to just a flat 2.5%. I'll give you a little more detail on that. It would be a flat 2.5% regardless of inflation or investment return. You may ask, why did we pick 2.5%? Well, it partly for two reasons. One is costs. We already build into our cost structure and our assumed contribution rates that we will be paying 2.5%. That's built into our cost estimates. So by just keeping it at 2.5%, we would not add to the costs of the system. If we were to go above 2.5, we would add significantly to the cost. So that's why we kept it at 2.5. Another reason is that this is sort of a trade-off. We would be telling retirees in this scenario that the investment component goes away, or the added inflation component goes away, So we felt that we would give some sort of trade-off to say we'll pay 2.5% even when inflation is low. So those were the two reasonings behind keeping 2.5%. And I will mention that your principles, which you're in the process of reviewing, they do stipulate that the post-retirement increases should be funded on an actuarial basis. So this would align with that principle. At the bottom of the page just shows you very long-term what inflation rates have been. In some periods higher, some periods lower, but it gives you a historical perspective. Okay, now the important cost impacts. What would happen financially if the active and post funds were merged? And we've shared these numbers with you before, but they have changed. They've changed significantly because we now have another year of actuarial data. You'll be hearing from the actuaries at your next hearing, which is a very important hearing, and I think you'll learn a lot from that. And so these numbers are updated to reflect the most recent valuations. And these numbers are all generally much better because we have had an 18% rate of return in this last year, so they're much improved. So let me go through them and emphasize that the numbers you're seeing here show the combined impact of the post and the active fund. In other words, they encompass the post fund deficit. The first slide is MSRS. The baseline column just shows you what the actuaries will tell you now where MSRS stands. They are at 92.5% funded. Their required contribution rate is 11.8%. That leaves them with a deficiency of 1.8. Again, that is with assuming the post-fund deficit in those numbers. The next column shows you the same set of results, but with the assumption changes that the actuaries will be speaking to you at your next hearing. Those assumption changes, we recommend that you make those changes. They're based on the most recent experience study. And they, in general, will lower the liabilities for our systems, each of our three systems, somewhat to varying degrees. So assuming those assumption changes are made, MSRS's funding ratio improves to 94.4%. Their required contributions drop to 10.4%. And they would still be left with a slight deficiency. Now, you may ask, why do the assumption changes have this impact? It's largely because we have been assuming salary has been growing at a rate that is far in excess of what the salary levels have been growing. And so the actuaries are recommending that we lower that salary growth assumption, and that in turn lowers our liabilities because we're driven by high five of earnings, and if you assume salary grows at a lower rate, then your liabilities are not as large as what you're assuming. So that's the reason, the basic reason. There are other things going on. The actuaries will explain that to you, but that's the main mover there. The last column is a little different look. It looks at the market value of the funds. And as you are aware, we currently, when we do our valuations, we smooth the ups and downs of the market over 5 years. This column just shows you what if we didn't smooth and we just went to market today. So the deferred gains are shown in that column, and it's much more positive. MSRS would be 100% funded. Required contributions would drop to 7.8, and it would actually be in a sufficiency situation. Now, I want to caution you on these numbers. That's just a snapshot of today. Our funds, it shows that our funds could cover the post-fund deficit, but a lot depends upon what happens between now and the next couple of years in terms of investment returns. So I would urge you to refer to this column but not rely on it because it really does depend upon investment returns. Next page is PARA. You'll see those numbers are similar. Its funding ratio today is a little over 73%. Required contribution 13.3% with a slight deficiency of 0.3. After the assumption changes, it would actually be sufficient by a small amount, 0.4, and going to market value, it would have a sufficiency of 1.4. So again, evidence that PARA 2 could absorb the post fund or cover the post fund deficit without any change in contribution rates. TRA has a similar picture, not quite as rosy, but similar. Today we have a deficiency of 1.65 that would narrow with the assumption changes to 1.35 deficiency, but going to market value, we would be slightly sufficient. So again, TRA could cover that deficit without a contribution rate change. So in summary, we currently show varying amounts of deficiencies today, but if you incorporate the assumption changes and look at market value, we would be in a reasonable position to cover the deficit. But a lot depends upon investment returns. I can't stress that enough. So in summary, our proposal tries to financially protect the post fund. Two scenarios, the adverse scenario, the bear scenario, as well as a favorable scenario. We try to reform the post fund if it continues by changing the mechanism, but give it that financial safeguard of merger if it is needed. We got some testimony from quite a few people that we really should give the post fund a chance to recover, and this proposal does answer that that concern. We stress we think action is going to be needed this year because the post fund is very dependent on investment return and therefore very vulnerable to potential downturns. We believe that the legislature really should take action this coming session and give retirees that assurance as well as active members that the funds are secure for the future no matter what happens. So with that, I'll just end and we'll answer any questions.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure you discussed this in a number of your meetings, but if the post fund deficiency falls to, say, 80%, then you're proposing to merge the active and the post funds together. The retirees are pretty much done contributing to the fund, but the active members are still contributing to them. Won't the active members have a perception that they're now going to be picking up the slack and they're going to have to pay for the deficit that the retirees are not? I mean, I can see some resistance coming from the active members saying, wait a minute, this, you know, why is this our problem and we're going to have to pay for it?
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, they would have that perception. They do have that perception. And I think ultimately they too want to have a retirement fund that is secure on a long-term basis. We really can get money from employees, employers, or additional investment returns. Those are kind of the three sources we have. When we have explained this to active employees, what we have sensed from them is that they want to make sure their pension plan is solid. The other thing from MSRS's standpoint, and even the other funds, if you merge them more quickly, that will lessen the potential impact if it falls further. You know, if you let it fall to 60%, then it's a more painful solution than at 70% or 80%. So while you are right, they do have the perception of bailing out. I do not think that at 80% MSRS, we likely would not need a contribution increase, very modest, even if the post fund fell to that level. But again, when we've met with them, they do understand the importance of having a solid pension plan.
Can you tell us how many people have attended those meetings and know what the discussion's all about?
Madam Chair, I think we've had anywhere from 70 to 100 people at each of our committee meetings. Okay. And then in our outreach effort, you know, we've had many more that we've explained this to. But we did have good attendance at our meetings. I would say the attendance was primarily from retirees. We held them during the day. And, you know, so in all fairness, you know, we had many more retirees come in than active employees.
Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair, I could also comment that we do have email capability through our website on the post fund article specifically. And we've responded to over 300 emails, and many of them have been active members wanting more understanding of this whole contribution issue.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a comment on the proposal in the more positive market. Just an observation. You indicated to us that there's only a 20 to 25% probability that the post fund will be fully funded. And in the more positive proposal, you also note, it's also noted that if at which time the post fund becomes at least 115% funded, then we'll revisit the situation. And I just think that's rather interesting, since who would have thought in 1998, when you were at 134%, that we'd be having this conversation. So while I appreciate that you were probably, or it's probably a desire to be present a positive outlook there, I think that we probably have a historical perspective here that should not be forgotten, and I think that it frankly is a little alarming that we would even consider that at the 115% level based on where you've been historically.
Well, just
Ms. Hacking,
I think that's a very good point. We share your understanding of history and try to remind people of that. The 115% mechanism is not automatic. It doesn't trigger any additional increase or anything. All it says is that if the post fund gets back to such a level, which isn't that high as you point out, then the three boards would look at the situation and have 6 months or so to come back to the legislature and make any recommendation on changes, further changes. It doesn't commit us to providing an increase and doesn't have any specific details to it, because we just thought that that feels so far in the future and we don't know what the situation would be at that point. So it's not really a commitment to absolutely increase benefits in any way, shape, or form. It's a commitment to come back and revisit and make a recommendation.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for this update. And I would like, before you run, the next meeting, as Ms. Hacking talked about, is going to be for the actuary and for the questions that we have in the presentation from the actuaries from Siegel Company. And they wrote a letter to us to tell us that they were available, and but we had to give them some upfront time. So yesterday I set the meeting for December 19th. And I've also been, when that request was made, the directors asked that it be at least be a four-hour meeting. So they're coming from far away, and we're going to listen and discuss with them at least for 4 hours, I was told. And now I changed it from 9 to 9:30, but today we had a little problem. And so should I change it to 10, make it from 10 to 2, or 9:30 to 1:30?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bergstrom.
I apologize if we gave you the impression that it would be 4 hours, listening to an actuary for 4 hours, even though there's one in the audience.
I was wondering about that, but then I thought you have a whole bunch to do.
We think 2 hours would be sufficient to...
Well, okay.
For the actuarial presentation.
Right.
I don't know if you have...
But then isn't there some other people that want to talk about something that has to do with actuary? I think there's at least one other thing on the agenda. And members, this is, you know, it's been a long time since the actuaries have been, and this is our big chance. too. If we can only know enough to ask the right question. But for their presentation, no, I didn't mean that it should be that the actuaries should talk for 4 hours. Gosh. But I think this is our chance. If we're ever going to talk to an actuary, this is it. For these plans and to talk about these charts and what goes in, you know, the individual bills that come before us, we always say, okay, but they have to, if they want to buy back, okay, but they have to pay the full actuarial value. And then it's like $115,000 or whatever it is, and they thought they would have to pay $8,000. I think we can ask them to address that issue also, and by what assumptions are they making for those kinds of things? So if it's shorter period of time, great. But I think we should plan on at least 4 hours. That's for next time. Thank you very much. Mr. Richter.
Okay. Madam Chair, you indicated December 19th, and you started to talk about what time that would be.
Oh, do you have a? Should I leave it at 9:30 to 1:30?
I have a meeting that whole day already. I'm co-chairing.
You're with him? Oh, no. Never mind. I'm sorry. I know. And it's very difficult, but we had to get it in this year. And I didn't think we wanted to do it on the 23rd or 22nd or whatever.
Madam Chair,
Senator.
No matter what time you start the meeting, I will be late, but I will be coming.
Good. Okay.
The later the better for me, but
no matter what time.
Well, I guess not no matter. With the choices that you've provided, I will be late.
Well, it could be from 10 to 2, or it could be from 9:30 to 1:30. I'm not changing other than that.
I will hurry.
Is it going to be catered?
No.
It's no lunch.
Unless you're offering.
No.
I'll leave it at quarter to 10. 9:45. Because that's what time we started today, and that's the time I got a quorum. So 9:45. 1:15. 4 hours. 4 hours. Okay, Mr. Richter, you wanted to talk about the post fund proposal.
Yes.
As a member of the trustees of MSRS.
Okay, I'll just repeat. My name is John Richter. I'm the elected retiree on the MSRS board, and I'm here today not representing MSRS nor representing any of the three statewide public pension systems. Now, there was some confusion the last time I testified a few years ago, so I want to repeat that so there's no confusion. I'm here today not representing MSRS or representing any of the three state public pension systems. But I am here today speaking for public retirees and those public employees within 5 years of retirement. The legislative proposal that the three boards want to bring forward is one of putting all of the pain and suffering for the deficit on the retirees. And those getting ready to retire. So it's just We have a deficit. We have a major deficit. And a few people are going to take the brunt of it. I was a member of the Joint Board's Post-Fund Subcommittee to address the post-fund deficit, and I am here to say that the committee did not do its job in solving the problem. The Federal Government Bureau of Labor Statistics has measured the rate of inflation at just over 3% on a yearly average. And that's those statistics are compiled over the past 80 years. So we know that inflation is 3% or better. The proposals that are coming forward are giving 2.5%. This means that retirees and people about to retire are going to lose 0.5% of buying power every year in retirement. So they're losing based on they are not going to be able to keep up with inflation. The argument always comes up that retirees receive those large increases due to the rate of return and added into the base during the late 1990s up to 2001. But it should be noted that at MSRS, and I can't speak for the other two retirement systems because I never got any stats, but I did get stats from MSRS, about 50% of MSRS retirees will be persons that never, ever received even 1 year of the increase that was in the after 2001. So by this time next year in December, 50% of the people retired are going to be people that never received any of those large increases. And so these people are suffering because they went through a period of time when the state was in financial difficulties and they were getting increases as working people that were being very minimal or even reduced in take-home pay due to health care and what they were getting in percentage. Now they move into retirement and they're losing at least 0.5%, and the realistic figure is they lost 0.75% each year since they've retired. So they've been in a lose-lose situation since 2001. And that, to me, is kind of unacceptable as when I'm the representative, elected representative for these people. That's why I'm here today. This is at a time when both energy and, in particular, for this group of people, health care costs are in double-digit inflation for these public retirees that devoted their careers to public service. Yes, the rate of return built into the pension base was and is a mistake that should be corrected. And if anything that comes out of this proposal that you would accept, I would hope that you would do that, because that is not a good thing for the safety of our pension fund. But you should look at least taking that piece that deals with building rate of return back into the base and removing it, because it shouldn't be there. Inflation should be there, and it should be something that is workable. So my comment about building or the rate of inflation being built into the base is take it out. I'm going to give just a little history of the post-fund solution. This has been an ongoing problem for some time. And back on September 16, 2004, at a joint meeting of the boards, we had Mr. Howard Bicker speak, and this is from the minutes of that 2004 meeting in September. And the quote here is, Bicker, speaking for himself, not for the State Board of Investment, stated that he believes the post fund and the basic funds should be put together. He realized that this is not a popular position and probably not realistic. A little bit later, myself, John Richter, spoke, and it says, Richter stated that he believes the post fund needs to protect the buying power of retirees. He continues that some of the plans before the trustees today do not do that. Richter agreed with Bicker that the funds need to be combined because not combining the funds, the problem will last 15 to 20 years before increases can go up from 2.5% to anything near the 5% cap. The cap means nothing unless the markets are doing great. January 20th, 2005. This is meeting minutes and a note from MSRS Board of Directors. And this is a meeting at which Bonnie Wurst, our actuary from Mercer, was able to attend. And just a quote here from those minutes, Ms. Wurst explained that the unfunded liability is being amortized to the year 2020, which is 16 years at 8.5% interest. She discussed the advantages of setting a fixed date, but having an amortization date of 2020 may be too short a time period. There was discussion about the effects of demographics, the current amortization period, and the increased life expectancy of plan members. Although 30 years as a long-term deficit payback did not make the minutes, Bonnie did state 30 years at that point in time. September 21st, 2006. And this is a note that I have that didn't make the minutes either, but it was from a statement that David Bergstrom made, our executive director at MSRS. And that statement talks about, David Bergstrom says, we should merge the post and the active funds. December 13th, 2006. This is a more recent joint board meeting. And this is a note from notes again, because these minutes have not come back before us for approval as a joint board meeting. But just two little things that were that I picked up or made notes on from Howard Bicker. And it says that we cannot earn our way out. That was the statement he made. We cannot earn our way out. So when you talk about the 20 or 25%, the probability is we're probably not going to earn our way out of this mess. Recommendation, to merge the funds. Again, Howard at that meeting said we should merge the funds. And so I believe that with this history, we should be looking to some of these people that have a good history with us and listening to them on a more equitable basis. Some other subcommittee problems as I served on the committee. No real time limit is set for the fund to be fully funded. There is no plan to get to the fully funded level. And you got people in retirement that are looking and saying, all we're ever going to get is 2.5%. Inflation's at 3%. We're going to lose our whole entire retirement career. Asset allocation was not discussed, but was supposed to be an agenda item. Alternative income for the post fund was not discussed, other than increased contributions or the rate of return. But there are other things that other people in other states are doing to get more money into something like their funds. And in our particular case, a post fund that has no other alternatives unless we come up with them and think outside the box. Fairness to all members in sharing the deficit pain. Right now, the deficit pain is going to be borne only by public retirees and those people about to retire. This is a comment on mine, but as I've observed over the years as being on the MSRS board and then dealing with the joint boards, both committee and boards seem to be controlled by governor appointees. In other words, they have the most influence on these boards. So what you get back coming here with any kinds of proposal are highly influenced by a governor. And I'm not going to talk about parties. I'm just going to talk about a governor has the ability to really influence what's coming forward here to this commission. So what I'm going to say is that there's basically no real solution to the problem, just more wait and see until things really get bad, and then we're really in a deep hole. And I think we need to do better than that. So I'm just going to offer up a suggestion and take it for whatever it's worth. I think we should have another committee and look at this thing, but I think that committee needs to be made up by people that have real influence. And so I'm proposing, or I'm suggesting, that you put together the committee and at least three members of this distinguished commission beyond that committee as voting members, so that you can go through the process and see what needs to be done about this large, huge problem in Minnesota. I would also advocate for two more voting members, one of them being the actuary, whoever the actuary you're going to listen to. We've got information from Mercer, and I know you got a Siegel coming in, but I believe that you should have an actuary actually have real input into this process, and I would make them a voting member. The other voting member I would entertain would be somebody that we all know, and that would be the executive director for the State Board of Investment, Howard Vicker. Now, I would like to apply to be on that committee, whether I'm voting or advisory or an informational. I don't care. But I would entertain that I could represent, and I've done a lot of work over the years for retirees. And we've done some of our own surveys that are way different than the people that testified at this subcommittee that we had of the three boards and the seven meetings that David talked about. I would also say that all three executive directors that testified should be advisory informational people at any committee meeting. But in the interest of keeping the committee smaller, you can put more people on it if you want it in a suggestion, but if you want to get real work done, if you make it too large, it's going to be difficult. So I'm going to quit there and just stand for any questions or comments.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Richter.
You.
Education Minnesota.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Renee Lara with Education Minnesota. My testimony, more than anything, is for purposes of putting our position on the record. So whoever is taking the record, we hope that you're listening. We have begun meeting with the committee members, and we hope to finish meeting with each and one of you regarding our position and explaining how we came about that. In regards to the merger, possible merger of the POST Fund and the TRA Active Fund. But first, what I'd like to say is that having followed this process closely, the executive directors of the funds, I think, have acted as prudently as they know how, given their options, have made a proposal that is looking at addressing a problem in a far-reaching and foresighted manner. Same goes to State Board of Investment and how they're approaching this issue. The problem here, from our perspective, is that there's a conflict of interest. It's a sincere concern of ours. Senator Betzold earlier mentioned that there may be the perception that by merging the funds, the post fund with the active funds, respectively, that some would view this as a shifting of the debt of the retirees onto the backs of the active members. Our members would not be incorrect if they assume that, because eventually there could be some more pressure for increasing the employee contributions to close that deficit once the funds are merged. And in a very real sense, the active members would be paying for that deficit created in the retirees' post fund. And we understand the issue that we need to secure the post fund. I think our members understand that. The problem is that, having been faced with rising inflation rates and low increases in salary and benefits, our active members are burdened already. And for them to assume in any way, shape, or form this debt would not be a justified solution. Inflation is an issue that that will probably get worse, but our active members are facing it now. So as a standalone proposal, Education Minnesota would not support a merger of the funds, given that the situation. But one factor in particular forces us to reach this conclusion and this position, and that is that two-thirds of our members lack the early retirement rule of 90 option, whereas the more veteran one-third of our members do have that option. So you would have kind of a double whammy. The two-thirds of our active members who lack that benefit, who when they work alongside someone who does, would pay for, potentially may have to pay more into the active fund to address the deficit. And that is the issue that we are facing, and that's what we're hearing from our members from the grassroots level. So I'll leave it at that. The last thing I would like to say is that this year, thanks to the TRA board, I got to listen to an actuary give a presentation, and it was long, and it was the first time I had heard anyone suggest that higher mortality rates are a good thing. So, and he, of course, was talking policy-wise, but you may be surprised at what you learn in your presentation. Thank you for listening to what we have to say, and again, thank you for looking at this issue. This is a huge issue, and we're glad that we have people like you looking at it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, just on the point of, you know, that I raised earlier on individual active members being concerned about having to pick up the debt of the fund, I'm sure the individual active members will also not want to go into a post fund that is underfunded. I mean, you know, they're going to catch it either way, so we're going to have to sort this thing out. But I have also learned on this commission that positive mortality rates mean a lot of people die, and in this sense, that's good. At least in this context, but actuaries do have strange terminology.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Laura,
yes. You mentioned, that Education Minnesota would oppose this merger. How does that reconcile itself with Education Minnesota supporting the merger of TRA with the Minneapolis teachers, when I believe the members outside of Minneapolis teachers got the short end of the stick on that one, and yet Education Minnesota supported that?
Well, first of all, Senator, and I'm glad you mentioned this, so that there is no confusion, the official position Education Minnesota has taken, and it was very carefully thought, was that we would not support a standalone proposal to merge the funds without a benefit for the active members. So when we say that we would not support a standalone proposal That simply means that if the merger was passed as a single solution without any benefit increase for the actives, then that is what we would oppose. So we are not suggesting that we oppose the merger under all circumstances. It just means that the actives ought to see an increase in their benefits if they in any way have to share being part of the solution for the retirees' deficit. So I hope that is a clear policy position. We understand the merger proposal. We understand where it comes from. But if it is offered and adopted only as a single solution and the actives do not see a benefit increase, we think that's wrong. But if it were part of a bigger package that also addressed the issues that the actives, particularly the Rule of 90, benefit, I think that changes the scenario completely, and I think that there are ways to accomplish those two things. So I apologize if, you know, we don't sound clear about that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lauer, I wasn't here at the time the Rule of 90 was discarded, but it was my understanding that Education Minnesota was okay with that proposal, too, because it was part of the package. So it's like you're asking to get back what you were willing to give up. And I still think that overall, in the final analysis, TRA members were harmed by the Minneapolis teacher roll-in.
Mr. Lauer.
Madam Chair, I apologize. Senator, there are other people here with more institutional memory about what happened then. My understanding is that the Rule of 90 proposal was approved in 1989 or 88, and it was approved for only those people who were currently active then. As time went by, new people came in, and those people did not have the Rule of 90. And over the years, that group has grown to become two-thirds of the active school employee population whom we represent. And that is the group, many of whom are now in their 40s, who are looking at a retirement situation where they would have to wait until 66 for normal retirement age benefits, whereas their colleagues could retire as early as 58 or 59. And, you know, having 64, 65-year-old elementary teachers is not a good thing to have policy-wise. And a lot of these members might be willing to retire. So I think that inequity is something that we're hearing a lot about from our own ranks, and we have been mandated by our representative convention to do something about it. Hence my concern about putting our position on the record and trying to be clear about it, even though we plan to meet with you individually as well.
Thank you.
No, not for him.
Oh.
Just a comment that I think it's important that we just don't have opinions or ideas about whether the merger hurt people or not. And if we say that, we should offer specifics as to exactly why you think that, because I think that message gets out and can get dangerous. So I just caution members to be careful about that.
Thank you. AFSCME?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Julie Blau, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. Our board has not yet taken an official position on the merger issue. This past July, Mary Vanek and Dave Bergstrom traveled to Duluth and met with our Council 5 board and had a very good discussion with regard to the ramifications for both active and retirees. And our board is going to have continued discussions and more discussion before they take a position. This is a very important issue. And I was sitting here thinking, you know, 1969, when the Pulse Fund was created, it's almost 30 years later when we're having a discussion as to how we're going to go about the future and to assure the stability of the fund, with both active and retirees have a obviously a vested interest. So as soon as our board has taken a position, we'll be back to you.
Good. Mr. Johnson? I'm not sure which hat you're wearing.
My name is Robert Johnson. I'm here today representing Teamsters Local 320, which is approximately 11,000 public employees in the state. We also do not have an official position at this point. We are monitoring and watching carefully. We understand the problem. We also, I would like to add that I think that the fund directors and working with Howard Bicker and working with the committee process, the seven times that they've met, the town meetings, I think there has been a significant outreach to try to communicate with people, to try to let them know. And that is good. But we do have concerns about our retirees and our active members if, in fact, there is a merger. And by the time that you convene in February 12th, I would strongly sense that the board of trustees that I represent would have some official position. We have not seen any language yet, and it's my understanding probably language will not be ready until after the first of the year. And so we're dealing with some concepts now. We're not dealing with very down-to-earth specific bill language. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes our discussion on the post-retirement fund, but to be continued. Ms. Vanek, or summary of the Public Employees Police and Fire Retirement Plan Disability Benefit.
Madam Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. My understanding is you just wanted some feedback on how the new provisions are working. I can tell you that historically, if you look at our actuarial reports, in recent years we've averaged about 60 new disability approvals in the Police and Fire Fund. Since this law was enacted July 1st, we have had three inquiries. One individual realized that he was retirement age and his benefit would be better as a early retirement benefit, so he didn't even apply for disability. One has applied, and it would definitely have been a non-duty in the old world, a regular disability in the current world, and the other individual applied for duty, and a decision has not been made yet. So the analysis is it's the middle of December. We've had two applications, and we average 60 approvals a year. There are still about 10 applications that came in prior to the effective date of the law change that are in process, seven of which are duty applications. But the report to you is that the changes in the law have obviously had a significant impact, and yet, you know, there are still many people out there who I would expect haven't reached the point where they need to apply for disability yet. But two applications in 5.5 months of implementation out of a typical 60 approvals in a fiscal year is pretty significant.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Martin, continued review of the Commission's principles of pension policy.
Members, the memo of the November 29th memo picks up from the discussion from earlier during the summer, and this attempts to take the existing policies and where the staff has identified instances in the past of legislation that varied to some extent from the principles to attempt to provide some input or some possible way of conforming, if you want to conform the current principles with recent legislative trends, that this could be done. So we've gone through those principles where we have identified legislation that differed to some extent from the principles to give you a policy discussion of what's at stake after identifying the variant on legislation, and then to suggest to you if you do want to make a change in the principles and want to have the principles more closely reflect what has been the recent legislative experience, how you could do that. And there are a number of policy principles. If you want to proceed doing these one by one by one, if you'd like to start doing ones that are of particular interest to our members, I'm happy to do it either way. We followed the order in the memo of the policy principles as they're set forth in the document that was approved last in 1995-96. We can start there if we want.
Let's do that. Okay. And see how far we get.
Members, the first one that we review starts on the bottom of page one, and this has to do with the creation of new pension plans. In 1999, the current policy generally disfavors the creation of new pension plans. And in 99, there were two new pension plans that were set up. And if we wanted to conform, well, we point out that on the bottom of page two, where there have been new plans set up in the last 30 or 40 years, that we seem to have favored creation of new plans when we were in four different instances where we were incorporating new public employers. This, for instance, when we created the ambulance service longevity award program, which is a quasi pension plan for ambulance personnel. Those were individuals that were, those were employing units, governmental entities, in whole or in part, that were not currently in public pension plan coverage, and we created a new plan for them. We've also favored creation of new plans when there is inadequate or inappropriate prior retirement plan coverage, for instance, creating a public safety plan or a quasi-public safety plan to replace general employee plan coverage. For instance, thinking of 1973, the creation of the state correctional plan. Prior to 1973, there was no special coverage for correctional employees. They had the same pension coverage as general employee plans, and it was felt that that was inadequate pension coverage, and a new plan was set up as the vehicle to provide more enhanced pension coverage for that group of employees. The third instance, or the third broad category, would be the as a mechanism to consolidate other pension plans. Perhaps the best example of this would be the judge's plan, where we had three separate plans for active judges and two separate programs for survivors of deceased judges, and those five plans were ultimately rolled into a single plan starting in 1973, the Uniform Judicial Retirement Plan. And the fourth instance that we've identified is the provision of supplemental retirement coverage, where there was the need for some mechanism to provide some additional pension plan savings programs or other type pension vehicles, and the creation of the deferred compensation plan would be an example of that. If you wanted to change the current commission principle, on page four I've set forth some language which would add a new paragraph to the current general disfavoring of new plans that would identify that new plans would be appropriate if they met any one of those four criteria, if they could be classified as trying to ought to accommodate new groups of public employees or employers, correcting inadequate or inappropriate prior coverage used as a vehicle to consolidate previously existing pension plans or to provide for supplemental coverage. So if the commission does want to draw on the experience of the past several decades and try and accord the principle with the recent developments of the creation of a couple of new plans. And the two new plans that were created in 1999 were the creation of the local government correctional plan, replacing PERA general plan coverage for those individuals who are staffing county lockups where there is significant inmate contact. And the other one was the creation of a special arson investigator pension plan for individuals who were previously covered by MSRS General but which have who have somewhat of a quasi-public safety or greater public safety component to their normal work effort. So that would, with the new language in the on page 4, that's where the two new plans that gave rise to this as an issue I would fall.
Senator Bergen.
Madam Chair, if it's appropriate, may I ask a question about that? When those two, typically we would be talking about a very small group of people, I would assume, when you're talking about new plans, for instance, like in 1999. Isn't it when the groups of people are real small, wouldn't a new plan be really volatile? I mean, to create new plans, I would think, would require pretty large groups of people to actually have something that has any amount of stability to it. And wouldn't putting something like this kind of open the door to more small groups that actually are pretty volatile?
Mr. Martin?
Senator, you would be correct in the smaller the pension plan, the more volatility there is, because the pension plans, like insurance programs, depend upon risk pooling, and the broader the group, the more likely that the actuarial assumptions, the coming to some conclusion as to how the group is going to change over time, work better with it's easier to identify the basis for those actuarial assumptions and the plan can be funded on a more stable basis. The arson investigators plan is a relatively small plan. The local government correctional plan is a larger plan. It's certainly smaller than the MSRS correctional plan, but it is a relatively large group by comparison to the arson investigators. So I think from an actuarial standpoint, you are correct. In the case of the correctional plan, we set that plan up with a full retirement plan, a full retirement fund, and they do have separate funding experience, and that plan has actually been relatively stable, but after the first year when there was some revision of the membership, there was some broadening of the membership, but that is probably a big enough group that it can stand as a freestanding fund and not have a great deal of volatility, or hasn't shown a great deal of volatility yet. With the arson investigators, it's a plan that is funded out of the general state retirement fund. We have a number of these little, relatively small plans. Several of them were set up in the late 70s. There's a special military affairs plan. There's also a transportation department pilots plan that met certain needs for small individual groups. But there, the funding is rolled into, the risk pool is maintained through the general state employee plan. and there is added funding, and there is some added actuarial work as part of each valuation to monitor how that plan is generally doing. We do monitor the normal cost of that plan. In the main, I've looked at these recently, the current contribution rates and the increased actuarial costs do match out reasonably well. So it does not appear that the general state employees plan is providing any particular great subsidy, if any, to these small groups. So thus far, while these are volatile plans, we've been either lucky or we had foresight in setting the contribution rates sufficient to actually cover the added cost.
I'm sure it was foresight.
So the first item and the possible change in the principles then would be set forth on page 4. The next principle that we deal with is on the bottom of page 4. It's somewhat akin to the first one. It's the public pension plan consolidation principle. The 96 set of principles indicated for the first time a general favoring of consolidation, or at least a need to have a more rational structure for our public pension plans, and suggested that voluntary consolidation should be encouraged. We've had instances recently where we've either didn't consolidate or didn't shift full plans together as rapidly as they otherwise could, or have used our consolidations to or have done consolidations on a different basis, looking at some of the volunteer fire consolidations. Provided some general discussion of how we've done consolidations. I think the thread that runs through here is what's broadly termed as a pension plan consolidation can run from a fairly simple transfer of some pension plan functions, such as the getting rid of a separate plan administration and merging the plan administration with another pension plan. And for instance, in 1973, there was a separate plan administration for the state patrol plan, and that was merged with the state our retirement system in 1973. The plan was retained, the pension fund was retained, but the plan administration was done away with in favor of another plan administration. So a fairly simple consolidation of one part of what is the overall pension plan structure, function, and funding can occur all the way through the Minneapolis Teachers Plan, for instance, where everything was moved from one pension fund to another, where the entire membership, all the assets, and in the case of the Minneapolis Teacher merger, all of the prior employees virtually were moved from one plan to another. So consolidation can run the full gamut. The potential new language can be found on the bottom of page 6 and the top of page 7. It mostly has to do with lays out that consolidation should be moving smaller plans into the appropriately situated larger pension plan. And then the perhaps new notion having to do with phase-outs of pension plans that have been obsolete, and that the elimination of public plan administrations should be done on a case-by-case basis, thus trying to accommodate the changes that we've made recently, having some statutory or some principles language that is consistent with what we have done recently.
Any questions?
think we have to conclude for today at that point on the top of page 7. And then we're getting a new one, remember.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, members, where this goes, these are the cleanup, or the way the staff has broken down this project is to identify those existing principles that need to be modified. We also have identified some areas where perhaps new principles ought to be developed, and that would be the next memo after this memo.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, just a question kind of on our process here. So as we go through the remainder of this document, is it your thought that we should be perhaps looking at these individually, maybe thinking about whether or not this is something that we would like to incorporate this change or not? And after we went through this document, we will go back and maybe decide which ones we want to accept and which ones maybe we don't want to accept. Is that what you're thinking in terms of the process?
That's where I am at this time. But I am also thinking about a subcommittee. But so if there's any volunteers or people of special interest, let me know about that. But I'm not ready to do that quite yet because I think there is a value in every one of us considering this.
Madam Chair, I would concur. I think that on a number of levels, this is a good exercise to go through. So,
but I don't know how many more meetings we're going to have before February. But I think I've been thinking of at least, besides the actuarial one, I think I've been thinking two, but I haven't, you know, I have no idea how busy July or January is, and I do have 10 days in Oahu.
Madam Chair, can we have a meeting there?